The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to issue 161 of The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world for the week beginning Monday, the 18th of July, 2011, with me, Andy Zaltzman, here in Wapping, where it's still all happening, John. It is, I'd imagine, pretty much like Stalingrad looked after the Germans and the Soviets had finished with it. But metaphorically so, clearly. And in New York City, it's John Oliver.
Hello, Andy. Hello, Buglers. Happy belated Bastille Day, Andy.
Thanks, mate.
I know that's such an important day for you. Did you spend your Bastille Day in the traditional way by completely forgetting about it?
Well, no, John. I did the usual. I overfed a duck to the point of cruelty, and then
ate it.
The French would want.
I celebrated my normal way, just getting confused about how many French flags there were around, and then saying, "Oh yeah, it's that." So
did you chop anyone's head off?
I didn't.
I know that didn't technically happen on Bastille Day, but still, you know, one you can't have one without the other.
They certainly had a good choppy run.
Yeah.
Now, Andy, I think I'm someone with, you know, a healthily low opinion of myself, but I've met a number of people over the last couple of weeks that make me wonder whether I should drop my opinion another few notches. That we put the piece about the space shuttle launch on the show last night, so I can talk a little bit more about it. I think I'd mentioned that a couple of weeks ago, I'd gone to interview Jim Lovell, the commander of Apollo 13, whose mission was initially to land on the moon, but then, after an accident, abruptly changed that mission to trying to get back to Earth without everyone literally dying. And I basically got to spend 2 hours talking to a legend, and he's incredible, not just for the things he's done, but for the kind of man he is now. I can't really get across to you how wonderful a man Jim Lovell is, Andy. He even signed a copy of his photo of the moon that he'd taken on Apollo 8 for me. So I was already justifiably feeling like an objective piece of shit after that experience. Then, Andy, we had this idea for a joke where, after Jim Lovell gave an inspiring speech, that I would be unimpressed and then recreate that speech with Tom Hanks doing it. Tom Hanks, of course, who played Jim Lovell in the movie of Apollo 13. Then Tom Hanks said yes. So I then sat in front of two-time Oscar-winning Tom Hanks as he delivered Jim Lovell's inspirational speech for me, sitting in front of two American flags and really turning up the Hanksian Oscar juice, acting up a storm while I attempted to act unimpressed. So after that, I felt like a talentless piece of shit. And then, after the show last night, I got to meet the guest. It was very exciting. He's only the second living person to receive the Medal of Honor since Vietnam. Leroy Petrie, who's done multiple tours of duty, one of which involved him getting shot in both legs and picking up a grenade to save his fellow soldiers, and in doing so having his hand blown off. And he was as funny, as humble, and as generous as you can imagine a human being. So, just to bring you up to speed, Andy, I now feel, I think fairly accurately, like a worthless, talentless piece of shit. And I've never been happier to feel that way.
Well, isn't that what the Independent described you as in one of your Edinburgh reviews? We're just catching up with it.
Just showing the working now. The statement was always true. Now they've just got stuff to back it up with.
My wife has kind of the opposite problem, that she's a criminal lawyer.
Yeah.
She meets people who have the opposite effect.
Yeah. I'm amazing. I've killed zero people.
So this is Bugle 161. Of course, 161. Not only what an assistant in a pet shop would say to you if you said, "I'd like to buy that tadpole, please. Are they still 75 pence or $1.21 each?" Yes, they are, but this shop is in Pyongyang, so you'll have to pay in the local currency. OK, I'm a bit out of the loop on exchange rates. What's $1.21 worth in North Korea these days? 161. Not only that, but also what a police officer would radio in after raiding a suspected criminal den and finding in it a First World War German soldier, a cartoon judge with an extremely aggressive approach to criminal justice, an insect proudly boasting that it can lift several times its own body weight without steroids and that it is one of the most biologically successful species of all time, one of Europe's leading car rental companies, and an early 20th century US Navy submarine that had supposedly been sold for scrap in 1922. A Hun, Dread, Ant, Sixt, E1. 1.
Oh.
Shall I bring them all in for questioning, Sarge? This looks dodgy. Also, an unhelpful way of telling someone that the time is 11:14 a.m. It's 106-1. I'd better get a shift on, Big Horse. Your train leaves at 9:137. Don't worry, though, if you miss it, there's another one in 31.6% of an hour. No, you f*** off. And we're beginning Monday, the 18th of July, meaning a happy 163rd birthday to cricketing legend W.G. Grace, owner of Victorian England's most famous beer, died in 1915. I still can't believe he's gone. Oh, well, never mind. Plenty more fish in the sea.
Top story this week, Hack Attack Part 2. And, well, Andy, the News of the World scandal has deepened this week, taking all the attention of News International staff. I presume that's the case, as they definitely can't have had time to listen to the Bugle last week. Otherwise, I'm pretty sure we wouldn't be doing this right now. So, just when you thought this story couldn't get any more disgusting, new revelations emerged that were even more sickening. Following this story was like walking through a fetid sewer, consoling yourself with the fact that things couldn't get any worse, and then having a pile of shit dumped on your head. The tornado of criticism got so strong that Rupert Murdoch was forced to abandon his bid to take full ownership of B Sky B, which is a tragedy. Oh, Andy, I'm sorry, I think I might have misused the word tragedy there. What's the phrase for when something absolutely awful nearly happens and then doesn't? Oh, lucky escape. That's right. That's the phrase I was looking for. Lucky escape.
So as you said, we are still here, which means, well, either, I mean, possibly means that no one in News International listens to the Bugle, or that they do listen to the Bugle, but they've been a bit busy with other stuff this week, and they're going to catch up shortly. Or that they have listened to last week's Bugle and fully endorse every word said on it, and every word said in your piece, which you stuck the boot in on The Daily Show.
But, I put my boot somewhere, and then I see as they ran extremely hard into it with the things that they did.
Yeah, I guess,
my boot was stationary, they ran into my foot, Andy.
Well, I guess that will be settled at the Court of Law, John, with the help of a physicist. But anyway, I thought I'd better find out for sure, so I hacked into Rupert Murdoch's phone.
And oh, that's good.
Would you believe it, that his hold music, John, is you singing Bon Jovi's Bed of Roses? And 95% of all of his voicemails are just Rebecca Brooks ringing up and going on about what an absolute dreamboat I am. And trying to persuade Rupert to sanction an Andy Zaltzman swimwear calendar to put out with the Sunday Times.
Wow.
Well, I won't do it, Brooks. I'm not a f***ing piece of meat. Unless by swimwear you mean whale skin. I guess that's swimwear of sort for whales. And I want the whales still alive. I'll do your calendar, even though you have now resigned since I wrote the joke. I will do this calendar only if you can arrange for me to be non-fatally eaten by a whale, Jonah-style. Because I've always wondered, John, what Jonah must have thought whilst inside that whale, because you know the Bible writers would have spun it like a teenage Chinese ice skater at triple salchow practice. Of course, the official line is that God sent the whale, gave little Jonah a complimentary three-night full-board mini-break inside it, and then made the whale puke him out in time to get home for his Thursday bridge night. But Jonah's personal diary, however, suggests a slightly different story, recently declassified under the Freedom of Information Act. Day one. F*** me, I've been swallowed by a f***ing whale. I thought I was toast when those sailors took me at my word and lobbed me into the f***ing sea, but I've been swallowed by a whale. I always wondered what it would be like to be a bit of plankton. This is going to be awesome. The trip of a lifetime. Day two. It is f***ing disgusting in here. It absolutely stinks of rotting fish, stomach acids everywhere, and the gas. Don't even get me started on the gas. I really need to tidy my room. And the big watery bastard stomach muscles keep contracting and expanding, trying to f***ing digest me. So I can't even get 20 minutes skip without being launched around his belly like a rabbit on a roller coaster. Oh, shit. I seriously cannot see being eaten by a whale catching on as a novelty adventure holiday. This whale seriously needs to eat some dried apricots if I ever want to get out of here. I am at the end of my tether, TBH. A die of half-digested krill and plankton carpaccio is not doing my figure any good whatsoever. And I'm pretty sure this whale doesn't keep kosher either. It's dark. Please excuse my handwriting. Oh, yeah. And I've been holding my breath for 36 hours now. Day three. I feel shit. Whale shit. Everywhere. All around me. I've got to get out of here. Through this digestive phase, I've been largely dissolved, I've had most of my bones crushed, and I'm now suffering serious oxygen deprivation. I'm beginning to think I might die in here. Hang on, now sounds like the whale's unfolding a newspaper. Must be a copy of Aquatic Mammals Daily. He's turning to the back page. He's settling down. Yes! Cryptic crossword, that could mean only one thing. I'm out of here! I've had some rocky relationships in my time, but I never thought I'd be so glad to get dumped. Day 4. Back home safe. God's been in touch. He told me not to sell my story or he'll whack me out with a lightning bolt. He can be a really domineering boss sometimes. So controlling. Obsessed with the growth of his empire, even if he's increasingly out of touch and relies on his staff lower down the company hierarchy to do his dirty work for him. Typical tycoon. Anywho, he wants me to hold a press conference this afternoon and say that it was a f***ing breeze being eaten by a whale, and that I was vomited up, not crapped out. He says he'll do one of his magic corrective surgeries on me, so I guess I'll have to suck it up. I don't see why he thinks the Bible-reading public are going to buy that patent bullshit, or why being chundered is so much more saleable as a story than being shat. But hey, he's the gaffer, and he'd better give me a really flashy new donkey for this as a deal sweetener. There you go.
Well, good point, Andy.
Yep.
Good point. Well made.
No point. Longly made. I think that's what we meant.
That's what I meant to say. So, police are apparently contacting about 30 suspected hacking victims a week now, after investigations identified some 4,000 possible targets. And it's getting to the stage where if you haven't had your phone tapped, you're going to start worrying what was wrong with you. Why don't they want to tap my phone, Andy? This is becoming a self-esteem issue now. Am I not good enough to tap? They should be tapping the shit out of this good stuff, Andy. I want to feel tap-worthy. Tap me! Tap me! God, the News of the World is the ultimate bad boy, Andy. You just want their attention.
So Rebecca Brooks has, the former editor of the News of the World at the time when the now-defunct ex-crap rag did not so much scrape the barrel of investigative journalism as detonate a landmine in the barrel, then use industrial mining equipment to dig down several hundred metres underneath the barrel just to make sure they hadn't missed anything. Anyway, Brooks has quat. Quitted? Quat? She's resigned. Despite the backing from the Murdochs throughout the schmozzle so far, and also despite being found by an internal News International investigation to be, quotes, completely and verifiably not a witch, she sank straight to the bottom of our jacuzzi of justice and has not owned a cauldron for several years now. Despite all this, she has stepped down as chief executive of News International, as the continuing shitstorm of justified indignation, opportunistic political grandstanding, rightfully appalled disgust and high-octane journalistic sanctimony claims its highest-profile victim yet. Brooks said that she wanted to, quotes, reiterate how sorry I am for what we now know to have taken place. And between the lines, I think she means how sorry I am that the world now knows that it took place.
So, yeah, that's the apology.
She also said she's planning. She was planning to resign anyway, in order to pursue her lifelong dream of being the first woman ever to cross Africa on a pogo stick. She said, "I found in recent weeks that being the epicentre of a global tornado of revulsion has really curtailed the amount of time I can dedicate to practising boinging around on my pogo. Some days I've only been able to boing for like an hour, and I really need to do 3 hours a day on the boing to build up to the Africa trip. If I don't boing up good in the next few months, I run the risk of being fully boinged out by the time I'm even halfway across Somalia. I just want to bounce." That all from the press conference this morning.
New revelations came out this week about Gordon Brown's financial records being tapped, as well as the newspaper finding out about his child having cystic fibrosis and very classily deciding to run that as a story. And these revelations also led to Rupert Murdoch and his son James being summoned to appear in front of a House of Commons inquiry board next Tuesday. The problem was that they're not British citizens, so that was not legally binding. And initially, Rupert Murdoch declined to appear, basically sending an RSVP saying, "Oh, what a lovely invitation. I was so glad to receive it from the court-appointed messenger who placed it in my hand. Sadly, I will be unable to attend due to a prior engagement of not being anywhere near your stupid f***ing inquiry. I hope it all goes well and that you all have a lovely time. Go f*** yourselves, Roop." So, later, reports came out alleging that he'd also claimed he couldn't make it because he was, one, allergic to panels, two, was too shy, and three, had actually died in 1994. So it seemed for a while like we were going to have to trick all three of them into appearing. MPs had looked into what kind of bait they might find the most appealing. Hugh Grant had said he'd be willing to sit inside a sack of cocaine in the hope of tempting them into the room. Then the inquiry would just jump out from behind a sofa and begin immediately questioning them. They'd also looked into hiding an attractive, white, missing 7-year-old girl in there, as well as a footballer and a Page 3 model. It was thought there was no way they could resist those three things, Andy. That's their three favourite flavours of catnip. But just as they were setting that trap, it emerged that Rupert Murdoch had caved under pressure and said that he would actually attend, which raises the likelihood that on Tuesday we will see him, his son James and Rebecca Brooks in front of the MPs, which Don King is already currently in negotiations to promote. And if they do get them before an inquiry, get ready for some pretty nauseating moral grandstanding from the committee as well. Because there are a few more disgusting sights in life than politicians ostentatiously criticising wrongdoers who they were completely complicit in not preventing from doing wrong.
As you said, there is a bit of a spat now between News International and former Prime Minister Gordon Brown, who accused reporters of, quote, law-breaking on an industrial scale and acting as a criminal media nexus. Strong words, and Murdoch is hit back by accusing Gordon Brown of lying in Parliament. So it is going to get feisty, John. This is, as you say, this is classic pre-fight trash talking.
Yeah.
This is... Actually, it would be good. I think maybe Don King would be the ideal speaker for the House of Commons to replace...
Perfect.
John
Absolutely
Burke
perfect speaker.
For the duration of this. But... The Sun claims that it found out via a member of the public that Brown's young son, Fraser, had cystic fibrosis. Anyway, here is a quiz for you. What did they do with this information once they'd found it out? A. Nothing. They realised it clearly verifiably and incontrovertibly had less than 0% relevance to the public as a news story, being as it was a personal matter of considerable sensitivity to the Brown family and their baby son, with absolutely no conceivable impact on how Brown could do his job as Chancellor. Or B. Splashed it all over the front page of Britain's biggest selling newspaper, then boasted about how it was setting the news agenda. A or B? That's a depressing question, John. Now, I know we all get questions wrong sometimes.
Yes.
As the 40% divorce rate in both the USA and the UK can testify. But I think they should have got that one right. I think they should have gone A. They should have gone A.
But even Gordon Brown, Andy, who I don't think anyone would say has not been a victim in all of this, was also complicit in the complete lack of oversight given to News International and their behaviour. As Prime Minister, he apparently went to Rebecca Brooks' wedding, and his wife Sarah Brown invited Brooks to a quote, slumber party at Chequers. And I do think that while they were slumbering...
That's an Anne Summers party, John, isn't it? Let's be honest.
Yeah. I do think while they were slumbering, Rebecca Brooks was probably going through their underwear drawer. You don't invite that jackal into your home.
So it's also turned out that 9/11 victims and their families might have had their phones hacked as well. And now, how, John, I'm going to give you a quiz question here. How is this going to go down in America? A, no biggie.
Yes.
No biggie. It's a free country. The home of the free, no less. People should be able to intrude on the private grief of whomever they want, for whatever reason, whether for commercial gain, pointless journalistic shit-scooping, or merely just for a laugh.
Yeah.
B, about as well as bombing Pearl Harbor did. Or or C, as long as it doesn't affect the broadcasting of American Idol, they can wear it.
Is there not an option D of really well? Really well, they'll be really happy to hear that story.
You can have D if you want.
I don't think it's going to be necessary. The relationship between politicians and News International has been a truly dysfunctional marriage over the years, and perhaps many people should have seen a scandal like this coming. Just listen to the wedding vows that they gave each other years ago when Murdoch first took control of those papers. Do you, News International, take this esteemed political body to hound and to investigate, to hack and to harass, as long as you shall be in print? And do you promise to do this with a poor command over the English language, and to undercut the gravity of any actual stories you may stumble over by placing them next to a picture of a celebrity in a bikini? And do you promise horoscopes? I do. Very well. And do you, political body, take this paper to prostitute yourself in front of, to cower in fear of, and curry favour with, as long as you shall remain in office? And when doing this, will you make sure that it compromises your ability to best serve your constituents, as well as compromising every principle you've ever held close to your heart? And will you take steps to ensure that this relationship is at best troubling and at worst criminal? I do. Very good. Therefore, with the powers invested in me, I hereby pronounce you two an accident waiting to happen. You may hound the bride.
Is that what's going to be said at your wedding? Well, they did. Politicians have prostituted themselves, as you say. They've essentially prostituted themselves so much that they might as well have dressed up all their policies in push-up bras and fishnet stockings whilst... What a dodgy-looking man was standing behind them taking 85% of all of their votes.
So, where now for the future of the press? That seems to be the big question in England at the moment. And Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg said, a raucous, probing press able to hold politicians to account comes at a price. Journalists will always operate at the boundaries of what is and isn't acceptable in order to unearth the truth for the sake of the public interest. And we need to have a proper debate about where that line lies. And it seems, Andy, that now journalist ethics are basically like doping in athletics. You just presume that everyone's cheating, it's just how much. And that means that there's a cloud over every story. There must be some way of journalists having to take urine tests after filing each report.
And that boundary, well, they say operate on the boundary, if I may use a cricket analogy. I think the boundary they're operating on is somewhere outside the stadium most of the time. But politicians have always loved a bandwagon, and they have had their jumping boots on this week. And the slamming the media bandwagon is now looking like a cart full of refugees desperately in search of food. But will this mark a genuine turning point, John? Because for too long now, the politicians have bent over backwards, forwards, and any other way the media wanted them in order to curry favour. But that curried favour often left an unpleasant aftertaste and disconcerting political flatulence. So, I don't know, I think they need a less spicy diet.
Stories to keep an eye on in the near future now. US debt ceiling. The roof is really close. Andy, everyone goes through phases.
So you've been going to cheerleading classes, John?
I'm going to answer that twofold, Andy. One, I'm going to plead the fifth. And two, I will say on a personal level, I have not been going to cheerleading classes. Everyone, Andy, goes through phases where they don't want to open their bank statements for fear of what is inside the envelope. And to put it mildly, there must be a lot of unopened statements piling up on the White House doormat at the moment, if Timothy Geithner has not already been shoving them unread into a kitchen drawer. America likes to find ways to make everything big. They like their cars large. They like their food medically inadvisably huge. And they like their debt unprecedentedly massive. Except it turns out that they actually don't like it that way anymore. They currently have a debt ceiling of $14.3 trillion, but they're going to need to raise that ceiling by the 2nd of August, or they will risk defaulting on their loans and plunge the world into the economic downhill ride of its whole life. In response to this, the top rating agency Moody's has said it may cut the US AAA debt rating, citing the rising possibility that the US could default on its debt obligations. And if any of that happens, Andy, things are going to get pretty f***ing medieval around here pretty f***ing fast.
Well, so are they going to basically just have to sell off all the land they bought in the Louisiana Purchase?
I just think everyone's going to presume that they're just going back to the start. There's going to be another gold rush. And I certainly would not want to be a Native American, Andy, because I think they may be getting driven off those casinos. The Republicans here are blocking the debt ceiling rise happening in a game of what's amounted to negotiating chicken to see who will blink first between them and the White House. The Democrats want the ceiling raised and to pay for this by closing tax loopholes on the wealthiest American citizens. The Republicans are willing to raise the debt ceiling, but only if there are no raises in tax. In fact, they would like some tax cuts in return alongside major cuts to government services. And this negotiation has been going on in the cabinet room of the White House, and talks ended Wednesday night night with, depending on who you listen to, President Obama either storming out due to anger or strolling out due to the meeting being over. And
but it's so hard to tell with his body
language,
isn't
it? It's so hard. It's so difficult. I have to say, Andy, also, I've actually seen that cabinet room myself on a tour of the White House, and it's not big. That is not a big room, Andy. That is a small room to put that amount of tension into. So it wouldn't be surprising if a man stormed out in anger, or indeed strolled out due to a meeting being over. Now, the two stories came out the following day in classic he said variations. Eric Cantor, the Republican, claimed that Obama pushed his chair back and said, "Enough is enough, I'll see you all tomorrow," before leaving the room, which is really stretching the term storming out to its snapping point. That is leaving, in the circumstances, heroically politely. I don't think anyone would have blamed President Obama for saying, "Enough is enough, I'll see you all tomorrow." And incidentally, Eric, you are a total Okay, Eric, good luck trying to exaggerate that statement to the press outside. Night-night. In fact, President Obama has said he wants congressional leaders to find agreement on the path forward in the next 24 to 36 hours. And if that doesn't happen, he says, the negotiations will have to continue into the weekend. So that's his threat. That's his threat, Andy. I think he's about as good at brinksmanship as he is at storming out of rooms.
That's 14.3 trillion, the borrowing limit at the moment. That's it's quite a lot, isn't it?
It's a lot of wonga, Andy. That is an impressive amount of Benjamins.
But I guess, you know, chucking another 3 or 4 trillion on top of that, you're not really going to notice that, are you?
Doesn't really matter. Doesn't really matter, Andy.
Well, it's like the difference between a 50-stone man and a 52-stone man.
That's right. Either way, you're winching him out of his window.
That's right. He is a defenestration logistical nightmare. Maybe that's why so many 17th century politicians were so f***ing fat. Just that it was an anti-defenestration move. Yep, they could indeed be forced to sell some of the Louisiana Purchase land back to France, which could be absolutely fantastic news for the bicycle, garlic and berry manufacturing sectors in Kansas.
Ah, you see, Bastille Day meant more to you than you thought, Andy. It did.
As I said, this is the Bugle for Monday, the 18th of July, 2011, meaning it is just 2 and a bit weeks until the showbiz event of the year, my Edinburgh Fringe show beginning.
Woo!
Bang up to speed on day one, it'll be. Absolutely bang up to speed, as always, give or take some days. 4:25pm from Friday the 5th of August to Sunday the 27th of August at the stand on York Place. Book
sell
your tickets
it,
now.
Sell it.
Some tickets still available, but they are selling like hotcakes, as in not very quickly from one shop in Edinburgh. And in a special promotion for Buglers, too tight-fisted to go all the way to Scotland, I also have a special promotion for my preview on Monday the 18th, that's tonight if you're listening to it on Monday, at Leicester Square Theatre in London. Half price, I think it's a 2-for-1 deal for any Buglers who turn up, or indeed any members of the public who turn up. So I think it's £6 or £5. And it's there's a sketch team called Domestic Godeye on first, and then me, and I've no idea what they do, or what they're like, or indeed what time it starts. But anyway, if you look on the internet, it's all there. Roll up. And if you think that's unfair on people who've already bought tickets at full price, well, there aren't many of them. And in fact, I didn't need to put the letter M in that sentence. And it's been organised at quite short notice, this. And if you think that's unfair on those who'll be paying full buck to see it in Edinburgh, don't worry, Monday's preview will be a total mess of half-finished material poorly performed.
Do come along!
It's going to be awesome! And now, what you've all been waiting for, it's part four of The Congressman's Penis, John Grisham's long-lost debut novel that we secretly hacked from his voicemail. Last time, Mickey Stantanio PI was on the verge of uncovering the real story behind the missing congressman's penis. Whose it was, where it was, and why it wasn't where it should have been. Now, Chapter 4. Senator Paul Crutchett had dropped a bombshell, and it had landed on his own foot. Ouch, he thought. That would have blown my toe off if it hadn't been metaphorical. The bombshell, not the toe. If my toe had been metaphorical, would the bombshell still have metaphorically blown it off? I guess I'll leave that kind of philosophy to Malcolm Gladwell, he chuckled, metaphorically rubbing a soothing mayonnaise balm onto his actual toe just in case. Mickey Stantanio finished what had become a very physical disagreement with the coffee machine about what constitutes a cappuccino, in which, for the first time in his professional life as a cop, PI and freelance trapeze artist, he had uttered the words, "That's just bubbly f***ing brown milk." Anyway, he sat down with his notepad as Senator Paul Crutchett prepared to spill the most refried of all possible beans. "Okay, Senator, fire away," said Mickey. The Senator took a gulp of water, sipped in the air as if wanting to eat his own destiny with a side order of self-analysis. "So anyway, Mr. Stantanio, I was speaking to Maureen this morning, and she said that Deirdre's been told she can't do any gardening anymore, what with her back, and of course Dennis is not long for this world anymore, and her Bridget's been having an affair with the vicar, and oh, it's not good for her heart, what with him being an escaped Sudanese war criminal, and his wife being a man, and then there's Enid. Well, if she will joust at her rate, she's going to get hurt. Mind you, if she must do it, she should at least do it on a horse, not a 750cc motorbike, and at the very least put some clothes on as well. And as for Norag, well, I've told her cesium and water don't go together, but would she listen to me? Of course she f***ing would. And I'll tell you who I blame for it. Heston Blumenthal and his fancy recipes. And anyway, my Albert's dead again. That resurrection really didn't go according to plan. Mind you, it probably wouldn't have worked out for Jesus either if he'd died with the garden spade smashed into his skull. Might have made the iconography a little bit more interesting, mind. And did I tell you about our Abdul? Yeah, he's got an internship with Hezbollah. We're ever so proud of him. But his Angela isn't too happy about it, what with them having just bought a house in the Orkney Islands and her being a Mossad agent and all. Very awkward it is. I give him 6 months, and poor old Agnes can't walk these days. And she's worried sick about the Greek economy and the Americans looking into the Kennedy assassination again. Well, that can't end well for her, can it? And did I tell her about my kidneys? Oh, in a terrible state they are. Yes, I'm going to have to get some new ones. Completely overcooked they were. Mind you, the steak and the rest of the pie were first class. Mickey carefully took Senator Paul Crutchett in a headlock. "Senator, can you please get to the f***ing point? Where is your penis and why?" Part five next time.
No, no, wrap it up! End it!
That's what Charles Dickens' editor used to say to him, John. And he ignored him. That's what made him the most famous novelist Britain's ever produced.
This is not a Russian novel, Andy.
Bit of a continuity error in it as well. It kind of started out set in the 70s. It just shifted. Never mind.
Oh, yeah, that's all of a sudden you're Salman f***ing Rushdie.
That's right, yeah, I'm just playing with perceptions, John. You know, nothing is what it seems in the world of fiction.
When this finishes, I've got a few questions on the general structure of the narrative.
Oh, really?
I'd like to put to you in a little Q&A.
OK, please do.
Yeah, I've got a few personal questions as well, Andy, so I'll wait till Chris's first, and then I think mine might take a little bit more thought to answer.
Okay. Well, are they going to be physical questions or verbal questions?
We'll see. They'll be verbal questions, but I'll be expressing them physically.
Your emails now, and once again, the threat to read out an email full of puns about philosophers has split the crowd somewhat. This comes in from Zoe Asquith, a concerned philosophy student. "Dear Andy, Chris and John, in order of hair fabulousness." Well, another gold. Another gold for Zoltzman.
Fair enough. I'm just happy to be on the podium.
On the subject, your decision to air philosophy puns. "I can't understand why you would read out a list of philosophy puns. Frankly, I'm neat sure they would be very humorous. You're really putting Descartes before the horse. There's no need to mill about like that. If you rustle your puns, you'll make a mistake. Lock yourself down and don't be a frager. I'm sure I know what would be Aquinas' thing to do." Bit of a stretch, that one. "Make yourself a Plato..."
Oh, Andy, you're in no f***ing position to make that comment. I can say that. You can't say that.
Well, is that just because of that cold and wet weaver one?
Yes, that's exactly it. You just lost the judgment high ground to say anything about anyone's puns with cold and wet weaver.
Cold and wet weaver? That was a classic, John. You know. That's a Hall of Famer, that one. Anyway, she continues. Make yourself a Plato Carbonara and get some air. Then don't Sartre any more of these puns. That's the rules. Rules. Sincerely, Zoe Asquith. So, I'm not going to read out the philosophy puns that were sent in a couple of weeks ago this week, but I might still read them out next week. I think Zoe has put me in my place.
It's like having a suspended prison sentence, this.
It sure is. Just hanging over you. Do it. Just do it. It's the expectation that kills you. We have a great email as well from Hannah Leverett, who says, good day, gents. In Bugle 160, Andy casually stated that if the Chinese population stood on each other's shoulders, they'd reach Mars. In the tradition of the frozen oil cricket bats that brought so much mirth to all buglers... God, that was awesome, wasn't it? I decided to do some calculations to determine whether this assertion is true. Data from no less a source than Wikipedia, so that's rock solid, suggests that the average height in China is apparently 1.6 metres. Da Vinci stated that the distance from the top of the head to the chin is approximately 1/8 of a man's height. Therefore, we can calculate that the approximate distance from a Chinese person's feet to their shoulders is 1.4 metres. The current population of China is around 1.3 billion. Therefore, if the entire population were to stand on each other's shoulders, they would cover a distance of approximately 1.9 billion metres. The Earth and Mars are about 55 million kilometres, 55 billion metres apart, meaning that the total length of the Chinese population would only cover approximately 3.5% of the distance to Mars. Therefore, unfortunately, Andy's assertion is factually incorrect, and I demand a retraction in the next bugle. So, take heart, America. China have a way to go to beat you, at least in the space race. As for global economics, well, let's just say you are royally and leave it at that. Yours, mathematically, Hannah Leverett. So, Andy, over to you. Retraction, well, please.
I don't see why I should retract it. I mean, for a start, there's flaws in Hannah's maths. She's assumed that every single one of the 1.3 billion people in China is fully grown at 1.6 metres tall.
That's when what you think Chinese, you might be even more
are
wrong.
Are Chinese babies born at full size? Is that what you're saying? That sounds racist to me.
Right, and she hasn't factored in there being a lot more Yao Mings in the world than we think there are.
Yeah, I mean, he's got a bump.
She's not factored in the possibility that the Chinese person on the bottom is on a pogo stick.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's difficult. I mean, difficult to say, for sure.
I mean, that to be fair, that error would mean that they would be even further away from reaching Mars, maybe around about 2.7%, but it just undermines her credibility, John. And also, no one has yet been to Mars, therefore we don't know how far away it is. It's just speculation from these so-called scientists. And they've got it wrong before, haven't they? You know, why should we trust them where Mars is when they couldn't even tell us what shape the Earth was for thousands of years? I stand by it. I'm not backing down. So, do keep your emails coming in to thebugle@timesonline.co.uk. So that's it for the Bugle this week. On Thursday, John, England v India, first test begins.
Wow.
Is that getting a lot of traction stateside?
Well, not yet, but, you know, it's not Thursday yet. I'm guessing come Wednesday night it'll be absolutely everywhere.
Well, it's a big series, John.
It's huge, isn't it?
It is a massive series.
So exciting, yeah.
I can't believe America still has not cottoned on to cricket. So.
Is Derek Jeter playing for either team?
I don't think Jeter is, but okay, I know that...
They're going to struggle to care, then.
I think Virender Sehwag is mulling over a deal from the Phillies to open the batting for them next year.
I'd like to see Dravid just blocking out pitches.
he did that in a test match in India, India v West Indies last week, in which... Indy were chasing quite a low total to win on a pretty difficult pitch, but they had a definite chance to win, and Dravid batted very slowly, and they ended up just walking off with an hour to go. India just needed under a run a ball to win with 7 wickets left. For Americans, that means they had a pretty good chance of winning. Not that they would have won, but they had a good chance. And they all decided, sod it. Let's just walk off.
Yeah.
It was like if Hillary and Tenzing had got up to within 50 metres at the top of Mount Everest and thought, it's cold. It was pathetic. No, I'm not blaming Dravid. Cricket shot itself in the face. But anyway, Dravid's a lovely guy. I had lunch with him in India. The wall. It took him 3.5 hours to eat a plate of carbonara.
That's one for you cricket fans out there. Could have eaten so much bigger a portion as well if he'd just eaten quicker.
So, until next week, Buglers, I'll see you on preview on Monday. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
It is going to be as awesome as watching me read stuff off a bit of paper can possibly be. Awesome. Very awesome.
Bye!